You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Adam Carolla has the Guinness World Record for the most downloaded podcast in history. So today, I'm happy to welcome him to my slightly less downloaded podcast. He has a new bestseller in which he takes down hashtag heroes, social justice warriors, cancel culture, and more. It's called I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, Navigating Our All-Woke, No-Joke Culture. And today he joins me on the show to explain why he's given up on apologizing to people, why he's standing up for his friend Jimmy Kimmel in the midst of the late-night show host's blackface controversy, and why he believes that people who virtue signal their outrage on behalf of someone else are really quietly racist. Then Adam says that the Me Too movement has actually gone too far. Guys need to man up and embrace resilience again, and our culture should stop getting so attached to statues and symbols. He breaks down his political philosophy for me and why he's sort of agnostic on the whole mask versus no mask controversy. Plus, he recalls his impressions of Donald Trump from his stint on Celebrity Apprentice and how a segment producer on the show hoodwinked him into getting fired in the boardroom. Coming up with Adam Carolla in just a moment. Adam Carolla is a radio and television host, comedian, author, and actor. Carolla is well known as the co-host of the syndicated radio and MTV show Loveline, the co-creator and star of The Man Show and Crank Yankers, and a contestant on Dancing with the Stars and Celebrity Apprentice. He currently hosts The Adam Carolla Show, which is the Guinness World Record holder for the most downloaded podcast. He's also the author of the New York Times bestsellers In 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks, Not Taco Bell Material, President Me, and Daddy Stop Talking. Now he's out with a new book titled I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, Navigating Our Woke No-Joke Culture. Oh, and he is also the recipient of the coveted Sexual Health and Entertainment, or SHINE, Award. Adam Carolla, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Adam, how does one win a SHINE Award? Do you have to undergo some kind of physical for that, or what?
I don't know. I do remember they would give us that every year when we were on MTV, when Loveline was on MTV. They'd give it the SHINE Award. It's a, back when everything was made out of Lucite.
Right.
It's in a cabinet not too far from me. One year I showed up to get the SHINE Award and got into a major, major argument with the producers of the TV show and left. And never did show up on stage and get the SHINE Award.
Mm-hmm. That's a terrible acronym, by the way. How does sexual health and entertainment equate to SHINE? Shouldn't it be S-H-I-E or even SHE? Because you usually drop the prepositions when you're doing an acronym, I thought.
I don't know, but it's all meaningless. And I'm sure one day it's going to end up in a hefty bag in the side of my son's garage. And he'll just back over it and angry after his divorce, and that'll be it. It'll all be left to the dustbin of history.
Well, I enjoyed your book, Adam. This is now, what, your fifth book, right?
Yeah, well, technically my sixth. Reminded me the other day, because I wrote a book with Dr. Drew a million years ago. We wrote a Loveline book. So yeah, it's my fifth book that I've done on my own.
Yeah. I mean, writing a book is so different from doing a podcast or a talk show on TV. How do you go about assembling a book like this, deciding which bits are going to translate well in print? Because on a show, you're just kind of riffing, right? Do you look for the bits that come up more than others?
Well, I have a system where I have a guy who I co-write these books with.
Okay.
And he listens to every podcast and everything that I do and say into a microphone, and then grabs stuff that he thinks would be useful and pertinent. And so he'll remind me of stuff I was talking about that I don't even remember talking about sometimes in the heat of battle, you know?
Okay.
So he is very diligent about sifting through all this verbiage and finding stuff that could possibly work.
So it's like you've got a real live, you know, in the moment book editor just going right through your every thought and finding the gold in there.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been toying with trying to write a book at some point, but then someone told me that authors only get something like 15 cents on the dollar, which, I mean, that's worse than doing an album for Berry Gordy. Is that about what it is?
I've done several albums with Mr. Gordy, so I can speak to this directly.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of depends, I guess, where you are. Mm-hmm. So if you're Michelle Obama, then you're going to get, you know, $30 million up front.
Right.
And then, you know, who knows how many units you sell or, you know. And so basically the way it works is this. If you're Michelle Obama, you're going to get multi-millions up front. And then once they break 500,000 units sold or 1 million units sold, once they become whole, uh-huh, on you know, it's called an advance, right?
Right.
So they advance you, you know, $10 million, and once they get past $10 million, they get whole, and then you can start whacking up the rest.
I didn't realize how it works.
They can give you $10 million and you can sell 10 books, in which case they're going to eat it. You know, you're not giving that money back. So they're kind of taking a chance.
Yeah.
When they give you an advance. And if they give, you know, Michelle Obama would get one advance. I would get another number that I'll just say would be lower. I haven't checked the paperwork, but I will get a lower number, but I will get an advance versus, I don't know, self-publish. You can self-publish. Yeah, like there's a version of all this stuff where you can just do it yourself,
right,
and keep all the money, but that means you have to do it yourself.
Right, right. And who has the time for that? Being that radio and podcasting are your preferred mediums, do you sell more audiobooks than hard copies?
I haven't seen the number breakdown. I can tell you that traditionally, no. But
okay,
I sell a large volume of audiobooks because that's how people consume me, as they say. Oh, it sounds very sexual.
Yeah.
But I'm going to look. I'm going to see, because I think this time it could be more like a 50-50 versus 70-30 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that exhausting, being consumed by how many million people?
I enjoy it, but, you know, I'm pretty, I don't know what you'd want to, I'm pretty sort of lackadaisical about most things.
Yeah.
I just sort of get up and go to work and then turn around and go home. I don't really concentrate too much on where I am or what I'm doing or what people think or who's listening. I'm just not, I don't know. Maybe it's a decision I made to just, you know, it used to happen all the time that people come up to me and go, I'm a fan, or, oh, I heard you talking about this or that. And I'd go, why are you listening? Like, I wouldn't even understand why people would listen, you know, and they'd go, I like to listen. And I've always kind of put myself into that position, which is I'm just talking into a microphone. Mm-hmm. I don't picture people listening. I think if you picture people listening, it you stumble a little bit.
Well, if you do, you have to picture him naked.
Well, picture the conversation you might have at an empty diner sitting at a table with your friend versus a few couples or fellas or women or whatever sitting within earshot of you.
Yeah.
I mean, it changes the conversation, right?
Sure.
So why would you? So that's what this is. I don't want to change the conversation.
Yeah.
I don't picture people listening. Yeah.
Now, you've been known to ruffle some feathers in your day, but you say in this book that you have now dispensed with public apologies. But I can remember way back when you apologized for something you said about Hawaiians and Filipinos. So was that the breaking point for you, or when did you decide enough is enough with the apologies?
Well, the Hawaiians, I'm trying to think. I called them stupid, I think, back in the okay. day, which is... It was a question that I posed on Loveline a million years ago, but I think we lost our Hawaiian affiliate.
Oh, really?
For that. I think I remember them canceling the Loveline. And Filipinos, you screw around Filipinos, they put a fatwa on your head. Like they literally will send a crew over to take you out. Like I remember I talking to John Stewart about it once. He's like, for some reason, Filipinos, you can't mess with those people. Like you need, you'll have to hire round the clock security if you mess with those people. But there's certain things. See, here's the thing, you know, this thing of like people go, oh, never, or I say never apologize. I don't never apologize. I apologize to, yeah, I don't know. I yelled at my daughter the other week and I apologized to her. You know, like you can apologize. It's not never apologize. It's, if you don't apologize to the mob, I guess really what I'm saying is if you're going on a rant and the rant is a negative rant and it's about Hawaiians or Filipinos, then you can apologize because you're saying something nasty about a group or a culture. If you are saying, here's my opinion on the coronavirus, or here's my opinion on Black Lives Matter, or here's my opinion on Donald Trump or Joe Biden or whoever it is, then that's your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't walk that back.
Right. And these days, what's the point of apologizing if no one's going to accept the apology? I mean, Right. You can apologize till you're blue in the face with some people and nothing will matter. No amount of penance will actually do the trick.
Well, it's because they don't really want the apology.
Mm-hmm.
They want to force you to give them an apology, which is different than the apology. You know what I mean? They're they're like people that, you know, it's like they want to take your money, but they don't need money and they don't even want your money. They just like the notion of you handing them your money. You know what I mean? They like the symbolism of it. So these asswipes don't care really about the apology. They care that they have the power to wring an apology out of you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what they like. That's what gets them off. I mean, what gets their high is your low, essentially. Yeah. That's what they're trying to do. As far as the apology, they don't even care about the group they're trying to get you to apologize to. You know, and it's like it's never even a member of the group that you were talking about. It's just some 26-year-old white chick who's, you know, hates her stepdad. So they don't even care about your apology.
Yeah. Yeah. What is the deal with all these people who are apologizing on behalf of other people? Like, I don't need anyone to apologize on my behalf. If someone offends me, I can defend myself. I'd almost be insulted by that, you know?
Well, it's a form of racism, which is these people, whoever these people are, aren't capable of speaking for themselves or defending. Mm-hmm. I must take care of these people. So it's part of that. It's narcissism meets, you know, racism, essentially. They're sort of backwards racist. They're accusing everyone of being a racist, but they're really the racist, A, because they seem to be obsessed with race, number one. Number two, they have anointed themselves the sort of leader of what, you know, what this group can tolerate and what they can't tolerate, and that they're gonna you know, be the spokesperson for them, which is a pretty racist thought in any group. You know, it doesn't really matter, like this notion of like I speak for the fill in the blank community. Really? How does that work? Who voted on your ass? It's narcissism.
Yeah, but in the wake of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and all that, you do have a lot of people of all different colors who are coming to show support for Black people What is the difference between a white person who is showing sincere solidarity with blacks in the protest versus those who are just virtue signaling? How do you tell the difference?
The difference is if you can hear them, they're virtue signaling.
Mm-hmm.
If you're aware of them, then that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If they're sending out a bunch of tweets and taking videos of themselves and stuff like that, that's in fact virtue signaling. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like if you know who they are, you've seen their image, you've read their tweets, if you know them, then that's the group who's virtue signaling.
And you talk a lot in here about cancel culture, so I'm interested in what you have to say about the whole issue of the statues being taken down. And you know, for me, I'm fine with taking down Confederate monuments. I don't have some perverse need to have a statue of Robert E. Lee, you know. But they, you know, now they're taking down or trying to take down a statue of Francis Scott Key, a guy who wrote the Star Spangled Banner. What did he ever do?
I don't like the general obsession with things that are symbolic in general. And the reason I don't like it for any group or any culture or sort of anything in my family, micro or macro. So, you know, I don't know, my son, and I'll give a dumb example, but let's just say my son is a Rams fan, and maybe there's some kids that are San Francisco 49ers fans at his school, and maybe he would say, I don't like seeing them wearing their 49ers jerseys around school. And I would say to him, you focus on the Rams. You focus on your own business. Mm-hmm. Do not worry about them. That's not going to change. You getting them to take off the jerseys not going to change the Rams' schedule.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's also the only thing you can do with the Rams is, you know, practice harder, work harder, be more focused, and whatever that is, study more game film. But you getting obsessed with that guy taking his jersey off doesn't help you one iota. And you could go, well, yeah, but, you know, how could it hurt? I mean, he's a Rams fan. It's hurtful to him, or it's a distraction, or it's a whatever. And I'm like, I'll tell you how it hurts. How it hurts is you become obsessed with taking that guy taking his jersey off rather than practicing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And so now you've focused all your attention on this guy and his jersey. And then you finally get that guy to take his jersey off. And now you feel satiated somehow, like you're quenched. You know, and they're like, woo, my work is done. Your work is not done. You have many things to do that have nothing to do with this. So I feel it's sort of satiating. Like how much energy have we devoted to statues over the last 2.5 months versus what has it done for anybody in anyone's community? I mean, imagine if that energy was focused toward anything other than literally something that is symbolic. It is a symbol. And also, you shouldn't be able to be affected that much by a piece of bronze that's 150 years old. You really shouldn't. You can say, I don't like it, or I don't think they should have put it up, or I disagree with that person or this person or their actions or whatever it is. And you can completely feel that way, but it shouldn't affect you. You know what I mean? It shouldn't slow you down. It shouldn't do anything. West Hollywood, on the side of the patrol cars, they have the gay flag on the side of the patrol cars. It's kind of jumbled up.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And why wouldn't they? It's West Hollywood, right? All right. And I think the percentage of gay residents of West LA or West Hollywood is about 40%. So it means the majority of the people there aren't flying the gay flag over their house, right? The majority of people aren't gay, but yet the sheriff's cars all have the gay flag on the side of the car. It's funny because it's jumbled up to look like the shape of West Hollywood, but no one knows what the shape of West Hollywood is. It's the gay flag. It's like a mosaic of the gay flag.
Huh.
I got nothing against it. My point is, shall the 60% of people who reside there, should they be put off by this? Should it be a distraction? Should they not be able to work? Or should they just go, I'm going to keep walking and go to work?
Yeah. Well, maybe straight people need to come up with a symbol. We don't have any kind of a flag or anything, do we? Well, I don't know what that would look like.
Friend, we got a Ram, as in Dodge Ram. You see this big Ram on the back of that? That is a straight dude driving that truck. Anything with Ram on the side. Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, at some point I have to wonder with all this cancel culture, is it going to get to the moment when Ford has to give up their name or change it because he was an anti-Semite or whatever?
Yeah, we don't seem to care that much about anti-Semites in my estimation. We're not, there are plenty of big time anti-Semites who, again, we obviously no one has any glowing things to say about Hitler, but yeah. There were a lot of folks, you know, Lindbergh and Ford, mm-hmm. that were pretty anti-Semitic guys, and there's no focus on them.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, you recently came to the defense of your buddy Jimmy Kimmel, who kind of got caught up in all this for wearing blackface way back when on The Man Show. What's the difference between when Jimmy does it versus when, I don't know, Al Jolson does it? If anyone gets an Al Jolson reference anymore.
Well, what Al Jolson did is blackface, like mm-hmm. playing a generic black character.
Okay.
You know, and what Jimmy did was play Karl Malone, who's okay. a black man. So like one is an impersonation. And I think this is really important because when you are just doing Al Jolson or blackface, you are just literally generically doing a black person for basically white people's entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Okay.
When you are playing Mr. T or Chris Rock or whoever it is, you are doing an individual. And thus it's not blackface. It's Chris Rock who is black.
Right.
Or Karl Malone who is black. So when you're in the realm of performing, whether it's The Man Show or SNL, if you wanted to do Chris Rock and you were Jimmy Fallon, would you do it with no wig?
Yeah.
Like, would you
right. yeah.
do
how
it
do you do
with
that?
Nothing? Like, no yeah. dress? Like, how would you do it? You know what I mean? Or maybe you do the dress and the wig and everything else and not the color of the skin, which mm-hmm. would then probably fall a little bit flat or play weird.
Yeah.
So to me, the rule is are you impersonating someone we know or are you impersonating a member of society who's black? And thus, that's my okay. division. There's
okay.
complete context for playing Oprah.
Okay, I think I get what you're saying. So the issue is whether it's a caricature of a race or a group of people versus an impersonation of a specific public figure.
Yeah, and like if let's say you were Eddie Murphy and you wanted to make fun of Donald Trump, so you did like a Donald Trump, mm-hmm. that's fine. But it wouldn't be fine if you're Eddie Murphy going, I'm going to make fun of white people. And he just did white people. Well,
yeah.
This is the same difference. It's sort of a specific versus a generic.
Yeah. You also tread into some more dangerous territory in your book by talking about the Me Too movement. I kind of agree with you, though. You know, it's heresy to even suggest that there's a distinction between a Harvey Weinstein and an Aziz Ansari. You know, a guy goes on a date and tries to make a move and suddenly he's branded a creep. Do you think it's gone too far at this point?
All movements go too far.
Mm-hmm, right.
That's how movements work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, has PETA gone too far? Yes, PETA has gone too far. Has the ACLU gone too far? Yes. Has the Sierra Club gone too far? Yes, they all go too far.
Yeah.
They can't stop. That's the whole point. They all go too far. Black Lives Matter starts off with Black Lives Matter. Next thing you know, their charter's discussing Israel. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, they just go. That's what all movements do. That's what happened with Tailhook. Start off as a couple of guys, a couple of pilots getting drunk in San Diego. Next thing you know, it's an orgy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All things, all movements go too far. That's how it works.
Yeah.
That's how it all works.
Yeah.
It starts off we need to start a movement so we can catch Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein. And next thing you know, they're getting Al Franken. That's right. How it works.
Right. Or Woody Allen. I mean, I feel bad for Woody Allen. You know, Child Services and NYPD investigated the allegations way back, a decade or two ago, and they said that there was no evidence. In fact, they even said that the daughter had been coached, and now it's just totally unthinkable that a nut job like Mia Farrow could make something up about her boyfriend who hooked up with another woman. This was all settled ages ago, and now the guy can't even make a movie anymore. He lost his deal with Amazon. He's done.
Yeah, poor guy. He only made 182 movies, and now they pull the plug.
Yeah, you know, the other one who got in a lot of trouble under Me Too, and rightly so, was Mario Batali. And, you know, I can tell you, I had Mario Batali on the show before all of this began, and you could knock me over with a feather if you ever told me that that guy was one day going to be accused of sexually harassing a woman. He was just so over-the-top flamboyant. I was as shocked to learn that he was straight as I was to learn that Rock Hudson was gay.
Your life is a series of shocks having to do with other people's sexuality, Ben.
Pretty much. I need to mind my own business.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even pay attention anymore. Yeah. God's honest. I just go about my life. I didn't try not
good
to
for you, man.
Care who's been outed this week.
Yeah. You have, as you call it, the obligatory chapter on Trump in your book. You're a tough cat to pin down politically because I feel like you have a strong libertarian streak, but then I've also seen you find common cause with conservatives like Dennis Prager and Ben Shapiro. Where do you fall on the political spectrum?
I am a kind of brass tacks, common sense, wisdom oriented sort of person. So I tend to agree with your Dennis Pragers and your Ben Shapiros because they're a little more just kind of bottom line, you know, in their there's no pie in the sky. I'm not with any group that makes stupid proclamations, you know, like no child left behind, you know, I'm like, right. Okay, good. Now how are you going to pull that one? You know what I mean? I want to start talking about a plan where some children get left behind, but hopefully less than before we implemented the plan, right? Yeah. So it's like that's my
realistic goals.
Yeah, I'm just like, look, I don't, you know, this notion that, you know, obviously everything's politicized. It's like, does school choice work? Do vouchers work? Yes or no? I don't care who supports them, right or left. I just want to know if that system would work or if it could be of some benefit to people who may need it. And if the answer is yes, then yes, then let's implement it. Yeah. And then you can tap me on the shoulder and go, well, you know, that's a Republican thing. And I'll go, okay. So what? Yeah. I don't know.
So what?
Maybe the Republicans endorsed the wheel or fire. I don't know. If it works, it works. Then right. I'll use it. And then maybe there's other things that I don't like that they don't endorse. So that's the way I'll do it.
Right, right. I mean, that's how I feel about mass incarceration. You know, if we're taking a bunch of people off the street, nonviolent offenders, and sending them to prison only to make them worse criminals and separate them from their kids and all that, that's something that's not working. That's not political. That's just we're investing more and more money in making people's lives worse.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. I mean, it's like I don't want mass incarceration, and I don't want you to be able to not ever be arrested for shoplifting in Seattle. If you're going to shoplift, then you get arrested.
Right. Like, sure.
Fine. You can have both thoughts at the same time.
Now, you actually have some experience with Donald Trump from when you were on Celebrity Apprentice. Back then, what was your general impression of him from your time on that show?
He was in a hurry all the time.
Really?
Kind of running from place to place. I wasn't a fan of his for, you know, obvious reasons. Seemed kind of pompous and arrogant and, you know, blowhardy. You know, all the stuff that everyone hates about him. It's all on full display in the boardroom. But I noted at the time, I said, you know, though, this guy's kids really respect him. And I always kind of use that as a yardstick to measure a man, which is, you know, they have that sort of situation where it's like Ted Williams' adult child hasn't spoken to him in 41 years. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Maybe he's not a great dude.
Yeah.
Like, if I would look at, you know, I may be funny. I may be successful by some accounts. I may be a New York Times bestselling author and so on and so forth. But if my adult children didn't talk to me or have a relationship with me, I would look at myself as a failure as a man.
Mm-hmm.
Not even really as a father or a husband or just kind of as a man. You know what I mean? Like, I somehow raise these kids who want nothing to do with me. That's a yardstick to measure what kind of man I am. You can't really look at income or, you know, financial holdings or real estate. It's like, that's a yardstick to measure what kind of man you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I noted at the time that his kids really liked him and respected him. And that meant something to me, even though I didn't particularly like him. I thought, his kids really do.
Yeah.
And that means something.
Now, the question is, though, do they like him because they sincerely admire him, or do they like him because they're all on the payroll?
I don't know. They all seem, they're all, especially Ivanka, mm-hmm. was very well put together and very well spoken. I was very taken by her poise. I was like, God, this woman is sharp and knows what she's doing. Like, my takeaways were sort of, Trump's in a hurry, kind of a blowhard, but I get it. Like, mm-hmm. I get that's who he is.
Right. And it's TV.
It's TV. And his kids like him and they respect him, mm-hmm. and they seem very well put together.
Yeah.
The kids. Like, they weren't showing up late, you know, smelling of scotch or anything. They were like, there, boom, here we go.
Yeah.
You know? And I remember thinking that meant something.
Yeah. I can't remember. How long did you last on Apprentice, and what did you eventually get fired for?
I lasted, I don't know, 4 or 5 episodes. I got fired because I got bad direction from their segment producer.
Really?
I mean,
what happened?
Well, they would give you the outline of what they were doing, and then they'd give you, like, here's the competition. You know, Pontiac is releasing a new car, and you got to talk up the car. And it was really kind of a cavalcade of bad coincidences or circumstances. It was first things first. I had Michael Andretti was, like, next to me, and they were like, Pontiac is releasing a new car. Who's going to be the team leader? And everyone just looked at Michael Andretti because he's an Andretti, you know. And what we didn't really know was going on at the time is his sponsor was Honda, I think, you know, who built his race engine. So he couldn't step up and do a commercial for Pontiac,
right.
You know. So everyone just kind of looked at him like, go ahead, Michael. And he's like, I'm good, you know. And it was like 10 seconds, everybody. And then everyone looked at me and went, well, you're the next guy who knows something about cars. Why don't you do it? And I was like, okay, I'll do it. So I raised my hand. And then when they gave you the briefing on it, they were like, you're going to get up there. You're going to launch this car. It's going to be like Steve Jobs launching an Apple computer, whatever. And so we went back to the boardroom, and I was like, all right, you know, you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And we're all going to be up on stage and blah, blah, blah. And Penn Jillette kept saying, didn't you hear what the guy said? He said, we're going to do it like Apple computer does a launch, like Steve Jobs. And I was like, I've never really even seen one. So he pulled one up online, and he's like, you see a bunch of people up on stage with Steve Jobs, or you just see Steve Jobs? And I was like, oh, okay. So they want us to do it that way. All right. I'll be Steve Jobs. And then you guys will be out in the audience, and we'll blah, blah, blah. Then when we get to, by the way, I kicked ass. Sorry.
Yeah.
I just memorized all the car stuff. And I'm good. Then later on, and I brought Michael Andretti out on stage with me because I knew he'd need to whatever, but he wasn't that good on stage on his feet. Then later on, we got into the boardroom, and they said, you were up there alone. You didn't utilize your team. And I said, yeah, well, I was told off camera that this is Steve Jobs type. They're like, well, you didn't utilize your players, man. Like, okay, well, perhaps you should fire the goddamn segment producer who told me to do it like Steve Jobs then. Yeah. So there was that.
Wow.
And then the next beef was they had two beefs. One beef is Michael Andretti is the car guy. He's the car guy. Why wasn't he the team leader? They kept saying it to me. I kept saying, I don't know. He wouldn't do it. So somebody needed, why am I being penalized for running the team that he refused to run? So the two big beefs were, why were you doing a Steve Jobs alone job? Well, because they told me to. And then the next beef was, how come Michael Andretti didn't run the thing, which had nothing to do with me either. Those are the two knocks on my performance.
Yeah. And didn't you also get the dubious task of having to roast Donald Trump? Now, he's not known as a guy with a big sense of humor about himself. How did that go?
It went pretty well. I did roast him at the end of the show, or when they came back and did the whatever event. And, they always talk about Trump being homophobic and racist and stuff like that. The two folks left at the end of my thing were Clay Aiken and Arsenio Hall. Those were the two people left. None of the, Lou Ferrigno's or Polly the biker. Like, we're all gone. Gay guy and a black guy.
I'm curious, are you in your usual studio, or are you recording your show from home these days during the pandemic?
I'm in my studio.
Oh, okay. So you actually go into work still every day?
I go everywhere every day, all day.
Okay.
I just got back from the racetrack. I fly Southwest.
Really?
I do shows. I travel. I go to the shop. I go everywhere.
Yeah. Now, you wrote an epilogue in your book that actually addresses coronavirus. And I'm curious where you fall on the whole mask issue. I'm sort of surprised that this has become a political issue, the mask versus no mask thing. Where are you on that?
Well, I'm kind of agnostic. Now, I remember 10 minutes ago, everyone was telling you to wear gloves and spray alcohol on all the bags you brought into the house, and every box that got dropped off by UPS, you had to wipe it down with a alcohol rag and then let it sit in the corner in quarantine and all that. And it all turned out to be nonsense, of course. So there's a lot of proclamations that are nonsense, and everyone forgets about all the experts that were telling you how we had to wipe stuff down and hit it with a Woods Light and put it in the microwave and, all this, right?
Right.
You think about think about gloves. Why did everyone put gloves on? I don't know. That's what everyone said to do.
Right.
All right. Who were wrong? And then wipe everything down and take your shoes off. Don't get your shoes. Take your shoes off outside the house. Mm-hmm. Wrong, wrong, wrong. They're wrong about a lot of stuff. So now it's the mask. And now, by the way, when the stuff comes along, they're thoroughly convinced. They're thoroughly convinced on wiping everything down with alcohol that you brought into the house. They turned out to be wrong. Now they're thoroughly convinced about masks. Will they turn out to be wrong? I don't know. Huh. They've been wrong a lot. For me, it's like, I don't wear the mask in my studio. I don't wear the mask when I drive. I don't wear the mask anywhere, but I put it on if I'm going to walk into a Trader Joe's, because that's what Trader Joe's requires.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it makes people have some sense of control and something they can't control. I don't know that it does anything. I don't know what look, here's what I'm saying. The mask, I'm not arguing against the science of a mask. What I'm arguing against is I'm on a Southwest flight with 90 people on the plane. Some people are wearing their mask under their nose. Some people are wearing a mask on their forehead and drinking a beer.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
Some people are wearing a handkerchief or a do-rag over their face. I mean, I'm sorry, people. This isn't science.
Do you ever talk to Dr. Drew about the coronavirus? What does he think about all this?
He thinks it's overblown.
Really?
And it's just there's 7.7 billion people on the planet.
Yeah.
We're not up to 750,000 dead on the planet. That's statistically, I don't know. That's not a good reason for a lockdown.
And one thing that comes up a lot in your book is this generational lack of coping mechanisms and basic life skills. What do you think are the biggest things eroding our resilience as a species right now?
Everyone is soft. Everyone is anxious. Everyone's watching way too much news and too much air conditioning and too much Grubhub and not enough time in the garage and not enough working with your hands.
Yeah.
You have to work with your hands.
Yeah.
You have to understand what tools do, what can hurt you and what can help you. And they've lost touch with the tangible world. And the tangible world teaches you about safety immediately, or you start losing fingers. Like,
right.
Really do. And you have to know what tools do. And when you lose touch with the tangible world, now you're in some sort of hypothetical world that we're all living in now. And that's where you can start coming up with all your crazy ideas and how this coronavirus is coming for you. And you lose track of numbers and danger and threat, and you lose track of everything.
Yeah.
And that's in the virtual world. And that's where most people are living.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully if there's a silver lining to all of this, maybe the coronavirus has been something of an impetus for us to start building back our resilience and getting out of the house and doing things, hiking, building something, who knows? Well, before we go, real quickly, you have a great list in here of the various types of people who annoy you. For instance, there is steampunk guy and drives a Jeep with no doors guy. Who is the worst of the bunch?
God, I'd have to look at the list.
Okay.
I can't remember everyone that's on the on the list.
Well, who annoys you today, aside from me?
There's Podcast Ben guy. The people that annoy me the most are middle-aged dudes that are totally fear-based. I just heard some college professor from University of North Carolina explaining they're not going back onto campus to teach because walking into the campus or into a building is tantamount to walking into a burning building. It's that dangerous. And I'm like, God, what a pussy. I would never want this puss teaching my kid. It's like a 55-year-old dude. These are adult educated males that are just pussies. But I would definitely not want my son being instructed by that guy. And I don't have to worry about it because he's too scared to go back to work.
Well, again, Adam's book is called I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, Navigating Our All Woke, No Joke Culture. And you can also listen and subscribe to The Adam Carolla Show at adamcarolla.com, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen. Adam Carolla, thank you. It was fun.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks again to Adam Carolla for coming on the show. Adam's book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, Navigating Our All Woke, No Joke Culture, is available on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Subscribe to The Adam Carolla Show wherever you listen to podcasts and follow him on Twitter at Adam Carolla. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.